Welcome back to From the Belly, exploring self, city, and God. And we're just getting ready to delve into an interview with Dan Russell, and we're covering a song from his 2018 record, Feel the Echoes. And the track from that I'm using in the book, Let You Be Mine. And we'll talk more about why I selected that song and Dan's interaction with the lyrics. And I first came into contact with Dan Russell's name by my relationship with Mark Hurd. And Mark and Dan had founded Fingerprint Records back in probably late 80s, early 90s. Mark passed away in August of 1992, and Fingerprint Records was up and running, and they'd already done a few albums. And so I saw Dan's name come up a lot when I'd be reading about Mark's life, and I knew that they had a real true friendship. Dan's a musician, a songwriter from Boston, Massachusetts. He's a concert promoter. He's a record producer. He's worked with the likes of U2 and The Call, Bruce Coburn, T-Bone Burnett, Sam Phillips, Michael Bean, who is the founder of the band The Call, who passed away in August of 2010, 18 years later than when Mark Hurd passed away in August of 1992. And by the way, Michael Bean and Mark Hurd were good friends, and they were good friends with Dan Russell. And another artist that Dan Russell has supported is Michael Bean's son, Robert Bean, who heads up the band Black Rebel Motorcycle Club. So that's some of Dan's artistic life. Dan and I have become friends over the course of the last year. Dan has been such an advocate for the book, an advocate for the podcasts. He's put me in touch with numerous artists that have shown up in the podcast, and I'm grateful for that. I've expressed that to Dan. He's an incredibly generous and big-hearted human being. I think you're going to really enjoy the interview. Dan actually was on a trip out to Northern California promoting his record, and I think doing a music video project, and so Dan was actually in the car, and we dove into the interview. It goes into some really cool places. Thanks for being with From the Belly, exploring self, city, and God. Enjoy the interview, the conversation between Dan and myself. And by the way, my wife looked at your picture on the front of the album, and she said, wow, he has beautiful hair. She said, I wish I had that hair. And I'm bald, and I said, yeah, me too.
when you have someone like Cheryl Payne, your hair does tend to get more beautiful.
More beautiful. All right. Well, at least you got something to work with.
Yeah.
You know, a good starting place would be, my introduction to Mark Hurd way back in the early 80s, which was life-changing for me. And without going into the details of all that, I learned about you through Mark's work. And then in 1996, I published one piece in my journey, and it was in 1996. It was an article in a very small journal that has ceased to exist called the Mars Hill Review. And I just wrote a piece about my experience with Mark's music. And it's interesting because I look at what I've been doing with Jonah, and I look back at what I wrote in that article, and I cited probably seven of Mark's songs and did kind of my own review on excerpts from the songs, the lyric pieces, which spoke to me about not only Mark's life and my journey, but so I was doing some interpretive work back then. What I've been saying on these podcasts, which is true, the day I graduated from high school, I'd never read a complete book. I really struggled in school, but I read liner notes, and that's where I learned, essentially, that's where I learned to read. And
that's a great place, because back then, liner notes meant something.
Man, I was just going to say, back then, you just couldn't wait to get the album because it was a treasure. And, yours, it represents that old way of doing it, that all of the content's there. And here's what I wrote in the article. It says, according to Dan Russell, Mark's friend and fellow partner in Fingerprint Records, in quote, Mark saw the world as a whole. He didn't just look at the good. He looked at the good with the bad, and he came out of it with some hope.
You know, it's, I can't believe it still triggers emotion. You know, he was my best friend. We had a lot of laughs. He was just ridiculously creative, talented. He could play any instrument. And when I say he could play any instrument, if he's, you know, working on a song, recording, and, you know, the idea is that it comes up that he needs to have a certain instrument that he doesn't own or doesn't play, he may go out and borrow it or rent it, come back and spend a half hour with it, understand it, do the math, record it, it's on the record, then return the instrument, and there you go. You know, no matter what, I wouldn't put anything past Mark. I mean, you go into his house and you look around at the furniture, well, he made the furniture. He was I was just powerfully unique. You know, Southerner, he's from Macon, he's real sweet. I think he carried a lot of hurt with him. A lot of hurt that a lot of us probably have as we grew through the phase of the, I say the 60s, late 50s, 60s, evangelical, you know, you get saved, your life is going to be fantastic. God loves you, you're special. You know, he's watching out for you. And then you realize as you go down the road a little bit, like, well, if he's watching out for me, why is my heart breaking all the time? Why is all this stuff happening? Mark and I shared lots of conversations, lots of off-the-record conversations. I met Mark really early on when he put out this record called Appalachian Melody, that kind of a watered-down version of who Mark really was, and it was just kind of a produced version, not watered down. It was a highly produced version, and Mark's hope all the while that his music would not be hid under a bushel in the Christian marketplace, and he was courted to record with the commitment of it being mainstreamed. Mark didn't, as a lot of us, we don't want to make our faith an adjective. We don't want to make Jesus an adjective, Christ an adjective. And when you get into that adjective culture, you can become dependent upon it. You do Christian events, you do Christian concerts, and there's a certain vocabulary and vernacular and jargon that you need to polish up. And any polishing of any of that kind of thinking always hurt. Those kind of compromises seemed unnecessary and seemed to diminish our sense of authenticity and our self-worth. And, you know, we were right there beside each other on that. You know, there were a handful of other people that were with us, too, other artists, too. Early on, I tried to introduce Mark to my friends. Mark would send me songs and on a cassette, these three song demos, and then sometimes four. So after about a year or so, I may have 20 songs, 25 songs, and I would pass them along. I was always trying to get Bruce Coburn to become more aware of Mark.
Yes.
Any of those artists at that level are oftentimes inundated with people's music, like, you got to hear Dan Russell's new song. It's like, oh my gosh, if I have to hear one more new song. I mean, it's great, you know, Dan's got a new song out, but I only get so many hours in the day. Mark was extremely generous to a fault. He had just a wonderful, sweet, beautiful wife, Janet.
Yes, I've connected with Janet about using the song Tip of My Tongue. You know, it's the first song that opens up my book, and so I've gotten to know her through email, and that's been a real pleasure.
That song and that record, Satellite Sky, was, you know, it was a concept record. Sonically, it was sort of centered around 1935 National Steel mandolin, and you hear that in
you
there.
You sure do.
Was it Mark Found, and just started to say, oh, I like the way this sounds, and all of a sudden out comes 25 songs. one reason why Mark was able to succeed at pulling off playing all these different instruments and parts was because of his emotion, because of his soul, because of his, you know, sort of heart connectedness to all that. Mm. I was educated, blown away, you know, by Mark's capacity to translate the landscape, translate the history, to project into yes. the future, to just move outside of gravity in a way, you know.
Yeah, that album is timeless, isn't it? That Satellite Sky album is timeless.
Yeah, and I'm aiming to remaster that.
Wow,
we've remastered Dry Bones Dance. I found the half inch analog tapes, and so working towards that. But just to re-release, put it on vinyl, real high quality vinyl, and all that. Just to do something like that costs, you know, $10,000, $15,000, or whatever, just to get it to a place where we want it to be. And so when there's no money, it's slow going getting that done. But my hope is to do all that trilogy, a fingerprint of Dry Bones Dance, Secondhand, Satellite Sky, and bring those out. And Mark's music should be heard by so many more people. And I think once we adjust the mastering to, it'll be much more palatable. And I think we're going to launch it at Spotify. And
that's fabulous. I'm sure that you still carry Mark with you.
Yeah, it's like he or I or both of us won't let go. My son many years ago, and I asked him what he wanted to do with his life, and he said, "Dad, I want to change the world." I sunk. You know, oh my gosh, you want to change the world? I gotta lower these expectations because you might end up being a waiter. And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Dad, you know, just like Apple, Google. You know, why do anything in life unless you can set out to do something that has a ripple effect that could make a change in the world?" I said, "All right, man, I dig it. You're gonna always be changing the world on the inside first, and be totally, solely committed to that, and then it'll just happen. If it happens, it'll just happen."
Right.
But Mark, you know, with Fingerprint Records, the whole concept behind Fingerprint was we each have something exclusive to make us who we are. We're unique. We're alike in so many ways. We're all related in so many ways. But your fingerprint, and most of us in this world, are either too afraid, or we've forgotten, or we haven't yet discovered who we are, and we don't like, and we spend our time doing facade management, and we just, our closet is full of facades. If I know I'm going to go hang out with you, Doug, maybe I'm going to put on a certain facade. My parents, my kids, you know, whatever it is, and to be so free that in this one point in time, to be so free to be who we are, and to celebrate who we are, that is a spark maker. It opens doors for others to do likewise, the same for themselves. And that's what good art can really do. And I think that was our goal with Fingerprint. Is when we got with a new artist, sometimes we'd be saying things like, "Well, who do you like? What do you, you know, what are your influences?" And then as soon as we identify all these things with this particular artist, we would say, "Okay, now we want to separate you from all that, and we want to make some room, open up a gap here, and bring you forward. It's who you are."
And you've carried this on in all the advocacy work that you've done on behalf of other artists. I mean, all the footwork, all the groundwork. And I know that what I've been curious about is the journey that you've been on, let's say since Mark's passing up to, the making of Feel the Echoes, which came out in, 2017. And so, that, you know, there's a handful of years in there of you journeying through this finding the truest you. And it really comes out in the record. I mean, what I love about the record is there's some sense of arrival, but it also is coupled with this paradox of you're still trying to figure that out yourself. I mean, that's what I picked up with so many of the themes of the lyrics in the album.
The only thing I know for sure, and I can boldly stand up strong and say this, is that I don't know. You know, I get suspicious of myself when I put my feet down and go, yeah, I got this. It changes, it evolves, and I can see it. You see different perspectives as our context moves, as our context changes in life. Our perspectives change, and with these absolutisms that we acquired, you know, from our parents or from our school when we were, you know, 15 or 16 and 25, and just got married, and, you know, I'm not going to change. These things I believe are unchangeable. And then all of a sudden, our grip around those definitions and understandings is ripped away. Mm. And we're left going, what? Am I either all alone, or am I just cut adrift by some force of supernature? I don't know. But, you know, here we go. It's a ride. You know, it's a journey. Yes. It's a sacred adventure.
Yes. Yes, yes. And, you know, back to before we wrap up with Mark and his work, the first time I heard anything from you musically was your cover of off the record Secondhand, Mark's 1991, kind of acoustic-based record. But I just want to get warm. Man, that was a great cover. I'm sure I'm not the first person that's told you that. That was a great cover. And not all covers are good, right?
Well, I got lucky then, didn't I?
Well, yeah, okay.
But, I I'm laughing about that a little bit because the way that came about, Mark passed. I was out on tour with U2, working for them, and I saw Mark along the way. Him and Janet would show up at a show, and it was so adorable, you know, coming into this 60,000 capacity room, and there's Mark and Janet, and like, you know, and I just want to dilute any tension or difference between them and you two, and Bono and Edge were quite aware of Mark at that time.
Wow, wow.
Yeah, just simply because I was with them, and Mark was, you know, my dear, dear friend. But, you know, so when Mark passed and I realized the finances were what they were, I thought, well, we've got to figure out how to pay off the expenses that were incurred. You know, when he passed, he was out in Springfield, Illinois for 8-10 weeks, and, you know, and then bringing his body back to California and everything involved in that. It was just, apart from the emotional shock, you know, where Mark's on stage performing, he has a heart attack. But you know, Mark, if Mark was in L.A., Cedars-Sinai had done this particular operation, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times, but this particular hospital had never done it. And, you know, we all thought like, well, and by the way, our partner in Fingerprint, you know, we were equal partners, was a guy named Chuck Long, who kind of grew up with Mark, and also from Macon, but he's a doctor, anesthesiology, but you know, he's you know, well resourced, but we thought like, you know, stay in the hospital there, you know, until you can do your stress test and get out. Get in a plane, get to L.A., get this operation done. Don't whine about anything. Think bad about it. Don't feel bad for yourself. You're gonna write books. You're gonna make records. Maybe move to Nashville. You know, at that time, I had two major record companies talking to me about signing Mark. But you know, then he did the stress test. He passed the stress test, and Janet is staying in a hotel just adjacent to the hospital, which was, I think, somehow linked to a mall. And so they got out. It was just exciting for them. And they went to the mall and went to a bookstore. And Mark got this book, sort of a behind the scenes of Gilligan's Island.
Wow.
And Mark, by the way, loved to laugh, loved behind the scenes stuff, mm-hmm. and had this humor that was perfect with me. And he was just on the phone with his sister. Just, have you ever laughed so hard you stop breathing? You just laugh so hard. You have to get that breath, and you wonder in that second if you have to get that breath, if you're going to get that breath. Well, Mark had arrhythmia, and, he died laughing.
No.
He didn't die then. He lost oxygen for 6-7 minutes, got him back to the hospital, and they said basically he was brain dead. But we all saw Mark over that 8-week period go from no reaction to anything to eyes wide open with headphones on, tapping his fingers to the changing rhythm in the song and following you around the room. And of course, you know, me, not the doctor of the partners, I'm thinking like, man, this is fantastic. God, it does answer prayers.
You're right.
You know? And then he got an infection one night and died.
Wow.
You know, they say about hospitals, they're dangerous places to stay around.
Oh, I've never known. I mean, you're giving me so many more details. These are details I'm sure that probably aren't even in print, but I didn't know anything about an infection. I didn't know, you know, the way I read the story was first heart attack, and then, you know, within 24 hours, a second heart attack, and Mark's dead. You know, that's the way that I've read it.
Yeah, I don't think he had a second heart attack. He just was recovering. I mean, I talked to him a couple times every day from where I was on the road with the band. I was just, you know, filling with hope because, of course, you know, like, you know, if you go in for an operation, you got a 2-3 month recovery period. You think like, oh, what am I going to do? This is so inconvenient.
Right.
The guy in his head going, are you kidding me? This is perfect. Let's turn this around to, you know, let's finish this. Let's do that, you know. But then Mark passed, and the money being what it was. So I just called up a bunch of friends, and the word kind of went out virally, and people started sending me songs. I solicited some, but many songs were unsolicited. And I was working with some friends on on another project up in Toronto, and I thought like, well, I shouldn't, as the producer of this tribute to Mark, I shouldn't record anything. I mean, I'm the producer. I want to get people that are a lot better than me and have more cachet. I mean, I didn't have any cachet to record, and we can get the word out about Mark's music and make some money, but maybe turn more people onto Mark, and that could be forward going. But so I'm in the studio, and you know, this band basically was saying, well, what do you want to do? And I said, well, it's this song hasn't been cut. I love this song. And we had a pedal steel player, and I didn't want to do a standard version of it. I mean, if I could do it again, I would make it a less of one thing and more of another. But
yeah, sure.
The band was so good. I just held an acoustic guitar. I said, okay, and we stood in a circle. Of course, we had a drum set, and Fergus Marsh, who I met through Bruce Coburn, the stick player. We just,
you had the right people in the room, it sounds like.
Yeah, I played the song maybe twice, you know, to a click, and they just looked at me, you know, like cocky, talented, amazing musicians, and they said, all right, we got this. And so, you know, one take later, okay, you're taking us to dinner. And I go, we got 8 more hours here, you know. We got to do a couple of takes or something.
Right.
So I went in the console room, and I listened to it, and I said, holy crap. I guess I owed them dinner. And one of the guys said, and a movie. So, you know, that was done. You know, the pedal steel, we put a Roland Space Echo tape echo on it, and the drummer reminded me of Stuart Copeland, you know, the way he sat up, played for
yes.
Of course, the Ferguson stick is impeccable. He covers the bass part, but you know, you got the high end of the stick too, which makes it even more unique. And you know, I think we put the Fender Twin. I think the Fender Twin was mounted and aimed on top of a 8-foot or 9-foot or something, a full size grand with top off. So we were trying to get the resonant sounds off the strings. So we had a dry sound and a kind of a weird sound. But we had fun. It was done. And then I had mixed it, though. And a buddy of mine in L.A. who has worked with me on Secondhand and The Call and a few other records, a record I did in Athens with another band called Vigilante's Love, he came up with a studio that was vacant, paid for a month. And so he said, come on out, we'll mix it. And that producer, engineer, is Jim Scott, who done Tom Petty Wildflowers and all kinds of records. He's just a wonderful guy. And I remember being in the room there. I put a background vocal on the record with my brother, and we were mixing it. And I said, how'd you get the studio? I said, well, Michael Jackson's here for a month, but he hasn't been here for about a week and a half. So the guy gave me the keys, and here we are.
Goodness sakes. I guess it's who you know, right?
yeah, it is. It really is. And how you exploit who you know in a nice sense of the word. But yeah, so that song has the emotion in it. And I thought about covering it live, but when I broke away from my work with Black Rebel Motorcycle Club a few years ago, my son really came at me and said, Dad, you started out writing, you had a band, you put it all down for other artists, so you're not going to make any money, but we've got a studio, come back here. And so I had a couple of...
This is your son, Jesse?
Yeah.
Okay. Sounds like Jesse was doing with you what you had done for so many others, and that is advocating for you to get your wings on.
Yeah. Only difference with Jesse and those others is with me. Jesse actually will sit down at the drum kit or put a bass guitar around him and keep my time. And he was my safety net from looking stupid and sounding awful. So I said, Jesse, if I go out there and my pants are down, it's on you, buddy. My pants are up or down half the time. Jesse is a musician's musician. In fact, Jesse's mentor, since he was two, his best friend was Michael Bean from The Call.
Oh my gosh! Wow.
So they would talk as he got to be about seven or eight every day, and sometimes twice a day.
Really?
There was a good reason for it, but with Mark and that song, that sort of came up that way, and that's kind of the backstory of being in Toronto with Fergus, and Fergus put the band together, and it was fantastic experience. I had worked with Fergus before too, because when Fergus would visit me, they'd come and stay, he and his wife, with me in our place. Instead of going to the movies or shooting pool, I'd like to write a song and go with a couple of musician friends and just go over to a studio, an 8-track or 16-track studio, and just sit in the studio and have fun. So the songs I did with Fergus earlier on were just, I didn't want to pull an old song. I just want to take it. Here we are, musicians. Let's go someplace. We got 6-8 hours. I'll write a song in the lobby or on the way over, and we'll bang it out and record it just for fellowship, not for publishing, but for fellowship. I think I'm going to put one of those songs on my next record. It's called Sinking Ships. But
are you working on that record now, Dan?
Yeah.
Okay.
I sent you that live track.
Yes, you did. Thank you for that. Yes,
yeah,
you did.
I'd like to perform them live, because in a live context, as opposed to a studio context, there's a lot more oxygen and a lot more life to reference in the song's well-being, in the song's trajectory, when you can play it off people and you look out in the audience after the last note that dissipates, and you look out in the audience and they're all sound asleep. You think, well, I'm not going to do that.
Right. So what's it been like for you to be in this kind of this new chapter of your journey, where you're not doing so much advocacy work for other songwriters, but you're actually doing it for your... I mean, what's it like to be in this space, to have one album behind you and you're working on a new one, you got shows going on, and I don't know what you're doing on the West Coast, because you're an East Coast guy. So what... You're in a new space, right?
Yeah, I feel like I'm finally come home. I feel a bit like Jonah.
All right.
And that I used my counselor of mine one time told me I had a second second place personality. In other words, I lack of courage out of fear or my self-esteem issues. That if you came up to me and said, "Hey Dan, I need you with me. I've got this project, whether it's a film or a tour or a record. Could you just carve some time out and I'll pay you?" And you know, when you have bands like U2 say that to you, it doesn't take much for you to kind of look at your repertoire and that you're playing these places in front of like dozens of people in a bar, and you're going on at midnight. And nobody can do anything other than call for more beer. I just thought, like, well, I'll put this down. But my goal always is, I've always written, and I wanted to share a perspective that emerged through my writing with the world that I was in, you know.
Yes.
But I just didn't feel it was good enough. I stupidly thought that if I can't write, Dylan or Mark Hurd, I should just shut up and serve those people. Write music is like an antibiotic, and if you and I discover that, a great healing, antibiotic, and we don't bring it out to the world, then we're criminal. And so every project that I approach was, we have got to get this music out everywhere and into everybody's lives, because if we do that and do that successfully, then the world's going to be better. And I know that sounds naive, but that's
well, it sounds idealistic in a very beautiful way. I mean, yeah, it's reaching for a lot, but I mean, that's where a lot of great things sometimes fall apart and other great things make it, right? So it sounds like you're in that space of that you're not as risk averse.
Yeah. Yeah, no. So yeah, the only, when you get to be a certain age, Doug, you don't care. You don't care what they think. I just want to be myself. I want to document. I want to and then share.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't make it on a particular chart or whatever. I just don't care. What I do care is that I'm true. I want to be true. I want to be authentic, and I want to encourage that in others. It's been kind of interesting because for me, from another angle, that my first album coming out at age 60, I've had some industry people say, "Well, Dan, it's fantastic. I think it's adorable. Maybe even cute that you're doing this."
Okay.
But you know, we really look to bring people onto our label at the age of 22, 24, and then lock them up. For as long as we can, and get all their music and get 4, 5, 6, 10 albums out of them. But then what I've got the opposite of that is that there's so many people that have come out of college or come out of their youth and just, you know, got married, got a job, got kids, got debts, you know, and they gave up who they were. There's this fingerprint in each of them that was kind of rubbed off, scraped off, tortured off. And now I've just been accidentally encouraging people.
Yeah, I can hear that.
50 or otherwise, to like, no, man, your validity does not come from that status. It comes from within, of you just, you know, being brave enough to be who you are. And then working with my son is another bonus. I tell you, every day I get to work with my son, I can't believe it. You know, I was on stage recently, and in between songs, kind of, you know, looking around at my feet, make sure I had the right pedal on, or, you know, my pants were still up or something. And I turned around, my son's at the drums, and I just looked at him, and I guess I looked at him too long, because all of a sudden I recognized through my days that he's signaling me to turn around and quit staring at him. Yeah. And I just turn around with this big, stupid smile, and I just use my thumb pointed over my shoulder. I said, "I can't help it. That's my son."
Well, I think you and I are in the same age bracket. I'm looking at 61. I'm looking right at 61. So, and you've definitely entered your 60s, right? So we're in the same space.
Yeah, I mean, I truly tell people I'm 73, just because they then will follow immediately up with like, "Holy cow, you look great for 73.
You look great. That's right. Let's shift to Jonah, because when you made that statement that you have just been working at being true to yourself. This is a pretty complicated project I've been working on, because trying to integrate these song lyrics into the reading of this old book that I think is, I mean, as you talk and I look at my own life, I think Jonah, an alternative way to read Jonah is trying to find the truest him. And he's really, what I see through the process, and without getting into the details of how I've come to this kind of reading of his story, I see his initial running in chapter 1, verse 1. I mean, this initial just impulsive going the opposite direction of what the command asks for. I mean, I think there's some things about the command itself that got that Jonah's running from, and that's pretty explicit in the story. The way I read the story, there's a suicidality within Jonah from the get-go, and that really came really into being for me, because I told you through some exchanges through text and email that my older brother, an only sibling, took his own life the day after Christmas in 2016, and that, I mean, my world was shattered, my faith was shattered, and I was working on Jonah at the time, and I also have just said to friends, even if this book never gets published, if it doesn't go anywhere, if it doesn't land, just to have something creative and artistic to work on, trying to get through the grief. It's like, but it was more than that, because then I began to get pulled into the story in new directions about Jonah's pain and what he's been carrying. But I think this book is really, and I'm a therapist. I've been at it for 30 some odd years. From a place of psychotherapy, you know, Jonah's the story of Jonah. I mean, he's in this journey and process of trying to get true to who he is and what's going on around him. And I go a direction with that, all of this conversation that he has with God in chapter 4 is really representative of all of this internal conflict of this God that he has digested from day one. And it's, you know, I mean, it's not boding well. I mean, even if there's a God that kind of shows up in the text as somewhat loving, I mean, really, the result in a man's life, Jonah, is suicidal. I think he's full of fear, full of anxiety, and I can feel something breaking out in chapter 4. And this is where your song comes into play, because this song, Let You Be Mine, which is what, the 7th or 8th track on Feel the Echoes, this song is, it hits me in two ways. I labeled it as a grief song, but the lyrics, and I want to read the lyrics that you have given me permission to use, and then I want to just talk for a few minutes about how, in my mind, it identifies a grief in Jonah, but also is a grief that begins to move him towards hope. This is from Let You Be Mine. It's on the 2017 record, Dan's record, Feel the Echoes. I want to go where the sun doesn't burn my skin. I want to go where the water is pure and I'm welcomed in. Where the words are not lies, where my soul can unwind. No promises, no fears to fight. I want to go where my heart won't shatter and break. I want to go where the love that we give, it won't fade. Where the dreams won't be laughed at. Every heart can be healed. Where nobody is nobody's fool. And, you know, I through my own grief, I mean, I've privately grieved, I've publicly grieved, I've been to a few grief groups and workshops. I went to a grief retreat here on Bainbridge Island, and it was my experience at that grief retreat. What it did for me is that it was so painful, so difficult to go through, but it was also so freeing, because I had such gratitude that I got to go through it, because it was restorative and healing. And I've just seen Jonah's life as that there's no space and there's no attention being drawn in chapter 4 or anywhere in the book. Jonah doesn't have time to grieve. Nobody gives him permission to grieve. He doesn't get to name his pain. He doesn't have language for his pain. But I get a sense in chapter 4 that chapter 5 that's not written and chapter 6 and chapter 7, because it's a story that seems like it's propelling, it's going somewhere. And it's like, I just saw Jonah at a grief retreat, people surrounding Jonah, people naming Jonah. This is what I picked up, and not only in the chapter, but I picked it up, your lyrics and the instrumentation of that song. I knew it when I heard it. The lyrics in your song speak not only about an individual, but they also speak corporately, universally, about we all need to grieve. And what I've seen is, here's Jonah, who's carried all of this on his back. And so the way I've approached Jonah is, I see him as a hero. I don't see him as failure. I don't shame him for running. It's his running that actually, ultimately, is part of what's saving him. So that's kind of what I've been doing with the story. And that's where your song fits into chapter 4. So that's where I've been with all of that.
I'm glad it resonated with you. I mean, it's a song that has a, I think, a pretty big dichotomy in it. The chorus itself is sort of the healing way out for me is to recognize what is there with me in the now, that, and who that may be. I just got done doing a music video for that. I just got done shooting. It's not edited yet, but you'd listen to that song, you think it's, you know, for about a woman being content with a woman, and in a world that is just constantly unraveling and constantly disappointing. I mean, are we ever going to find a place to be at peace in? And we possibly will if we can shut off the news and stay away from social media. But I did. So I treated the video my son is the second principal in there about a rift between us and the healing of that rift. It's when I say let your body, your body next to mine, it doesn't have to be a sexual connotation at all. It can be like, just look around, who is next to you, and don't be afraid to go over and do a 20-second hug or embrace on that person. Not a quick 2-second hug. But I mean, hold on.
Right.
One thing I've been chasing my whole life is the notion, and I guess you could say the belief, that we each have souls, and our souls are eternal in nature. And so each of us are walking around with eternity within us. That person sitting across from you is an eternal entity, covered in that flesh and blood. And only here for a short time. But to be a soul-connected person, to live from the inside out, to pursue that kind of living and thinking, I think it resonates throughout the world. You know, if many, many have inklings that they are eternal in nature and they have souls, then without becoming religious about it at all, please, is how do we nurture one another's soul? How do we nurture our own soul? How do we live with that in mind? And so, you know, on the one hand, the world's unraveling, and we could come up with 100 examples of that. And on the other hand, I'm sitting here talking to you in Yosemite Park, and I'm just, you know, this is amazing. And this, so I'm choosing love over fear. I'm choosing quiet over noise. So let you be mine is me saying, listen, I want to let you be mine. And that's enough. Be content. I'm not talking about possessiveness. I'm talking about being content with all this rather than the push to achieve and validate myself based on achievement or anything like that. You know? So that song came out like that. And I'm so glad it resonates with you.
Oh, Dan, thank you for just unpacking that a bit. And boy, I look forward to, so the video's done, it's yet to be edited, and it'll be available. When will that be available?
You know, I heard at the end of this month, I shot two videos. That was one, and Is It Love is the other video I did. It's so much different now than it was when I was starting out in this business back in the late 70s and early 80s.
Yeah, the changes you've seen, my goodness. I mean, that's like going from the rotary phone to the cell phone within a very short period of time, right?
I say now we're now living in the fantasy world of the 60s. So back in the 60s, we'd look at today living and we call it a fantasy.
Yeah. I went back on your website this morning, just poking around and looking for, you know, kind of things to maybe mention. And I saw the name Carter Allen, and I'm thinking, wait, I saw that picture of you and Carter. I'm like, I know Carter. We're, and then like, what, 7, 8, 9 years ago, the coolest interview with Mike Peters from The Alarm with Carter Allen. That, and I remembered, okay, so yeah. And I thought, wow, Dan hangs out. You've got some very, very sweet, cool, gifted people you get to hang out with.
Carter and I went to see you two for the first time at the Paradise in Boston. So yeah. I knew Carter from back then, and you know, Carter to me was a knight in shining armor in the Boston rock scene. He was the music director for WBCN in Boston, and he still works at a big station called ZLX and is a DJ music director there. And he does a nationally syndicated blues program, and he authors one book after another. He's got a book that he just re-released. About you two called Outside It's America. I've released books on Allman Brothers and others, and people love him. He's got such a beautiful personality that sit and talk with Carter. He's been to so many shows and connect with so many people. And the power of music. I refer to music as a superpower. In the age of the Avengers and what have you, music is transcends time and geography and can really connect with people hundreds of years from now. They have that ability then to hear the music from the past, which I'm sure they will. But Carter tapped into it. He was a motivator. He was the sweet side, the innocent, beautiful side of the rock and roll scene in Boston. And
okay.
I've been friends with him for probably since, I think we met 79 or 78, 79.
So you were born and raised in the Boston area?
Yes.
Okay. Well, man, how cool is it that you get to write music, you get to play instruments, and do we ever get to like trade fingerprints with people just for maybe just a, like even just a day or so, where I could actually pick up a guitar and know how to play it and actually write a song and get up and perform it? I mean, does that ever happen, or is that in another world?
You know what? Maybe in this next phase of our soul's existence, because I think, you know, we shouldn't sweat a lot of this. We shouldn't say, I wish I could be this, that, and other.
Okay.
Here I am just being me. I'm stuck being who I am. It's rather than that, it's like, I want to dive completely into the depths of who I am, because in a minute, I'm going to transcend, and this gift I call the last breath, I refer to our last breath as a gift, because when you expel that last breath, you will no longer have to deal with all the stuff that you've had to deal with. You'll be freed. The chain will be broken. You'll be freed, and you can go forward from there. And we're healed and whole at that point. But until such time, it's like, you know, it's only a few minutes away. Why don't we cannonball in? Let's do a belly flop into our own lives and have some fun, you know. Because, you know, I don't believe God suffers low self-esteem and needs us to lift him up, or I don't think God God's brand is suffering and needs us to give him some pointers on how to not succumb or lose an election. I think probably what God wants of us all is to maybe, you know, in some intimate, quiet ways, to hold our hands and just go for a walk where we're not, you know, where we're away from all the craziness, you know.
All the craziness. I was just going to say all the craziness. Well, Dan, this has been, man, this has been very, very inspirational. You have a gift of being inspiring. I really, really feel that. So thank you for what you're doing and your work for the world. Thank you for spending this time with me. Thank you for the friendship that we've had just through emails, and I hope we can stay in contact. And
I definitely want to get back to Seattle, do the Vancouver, Seattle
good
circuit. I've done it so many times with Sam Phillips and The Call and U2 and Black Rebel Motorcycle Club and others, you know. I want to do it for me this time.
There you go. Dan, thank you, man. Thank you. Thanks for the time. Bye-bye.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that episode. Sure enjoyed conducting that. It was just a really good time to get to know Dan. He and I had spoken before, but we had never really did a deep dive into his artistic life and his relationship with Mark Hurd, and I greatly appreciated that. Dan writes, I want to go where the sun doesn't burn my skin. I want to go where the water is pure and I'm welcomed in. Where the words are not lies, where my soul can unwind. No promises, no fears to fight. I use some other lyrics from the song in my book, but that's just a portion. I want to go where the sun doesn't burn my skin. I want to go where where the water is pure and I'm welcomed in. Where the words are not lies, where my soul can unwind. No promises, no fears to fight. And so in that I hear a place of peace and rest for Jonah from the belly, exploring self, city, and God. And we'll talk to you soon. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.